Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Today's episode is one we produced earlier this year about science and movies. Let's say you're at the movie theater. You have your popcorn, the seat is comfortable, and the film is about to begin.
The world's most immersive movie experience begins now.
You're settling into the experience, and soon you're hooked into the story. The audience may be mesmerized by the film, but James Cutting is mesmerized by the audience's eyes.
Everyone looks at the same place.
Like a cat following a laser pointer, even though there are so many things on the screen you could be looking at.
It's really astonishing. It's called eye movement synchrony across viewers. So if you've got 30 viewers with an eye tracker looking at the movie, almost all of them are looking at the exact same spot.
James teaches psychology at Cornell University, and he studies film structure and patterns in movies. He says filmmakers are directing our gaze in a way that holds our attention. For example, if there is a person in the scene, our eyes tend to follow them.
So when a character moves slightly off, let's say, to the left, and there's a cut that comes, the new shot will begin with either another character or an object pretty much in the same location that was in the last frame of the previous shot.
So if Idris Elba just walked to the left, whatever the audience is supposed to look at in the next shot will conveniently also be on the left. If they don't have to move their eyes,
then you've already sucked them into what's coming up. They don't have to seek it out. The synapses in the brain don't have to lie fallow for 250 milliseconds. And so I think this is one of the ways that movies grab us, is by not having downtime for viewers with respect to things to look at.
James studies these things because he's fascinated with a basic question about movies.
Why everyone finds them so engrossing?
We know it's not real, it's a movie, but still, when great actors deliver their lines, we believe them.
Well, I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you?
Do not compare me to my father!
I didn't compare you to him, I said you were acting like him.
When something sad happens, we cry.
I wish I knew how to quit you.
Wilson! Wilson!
But mostly I hate the way I don't hate you. Not even close. Not even a little bit.
Or when we know something terrifying is about to happen, we get freaked out. We might even get goosebumps.
I see dead people.
What creates these strong reactions within us? What makes the illusion so compelling? On today's show, we look to science to explain how movie magic works in our brains and plays out in our emotions. First up, sound is a big part of the illusion that movies create. That whoosh when a spaceship flies by, the finality of a dungeon door closing, or the creepy howl of a wolf looking for prey. Reporter Ari Saperstein takes us behind the scenes in Hollywood to meet some of the people who are creating those sounds, Foley artists.
Odds are, when you hear a punch in a fight scene, or footsteps in a chase scene, it's likely not the actual sound from the movie set.
We basically just take all the little sounds that you don't think about in movies and we fake them and make it so they're present in the recording.
Edward Bridges is an expert in faking all the everyday sounds in a film that make up a movie's soundscape. When I meet up with Edward and the Foley team at Roundabout Studios in Los Angeles, they're working on a fight scene.
This scene is the start of the fight.
A studio engineer gives instructions from behind a glass panel as footage of the scene plays on a monitor. Two characters tussling on the ground. In the Foley studio, Edward starts grabbing props.
I like to wrap up this boxing glove into this jean jacket here, and then you can sort of like, yeah, I'll try to make it a little less poofy.
Once Edward finds the right level of poofiness, he's ready to record. And the engineer approves.
Yeah, that sounded really nice.
Sweet.
Most of the sounds Foley artists need to recreate are a little more pedestrian, literally. For example, walking makes up a big part of their day, as does eating. Achieving those sounds is pretty straightforward. Edward can walk in place and munch on a bag of chips. But when it comes to more gruesome moments, like the sound of bones breaking, you might not have access to a cadaver and probably don't want to hurt anybody. So instead, Foley artists will use celery.
They'll freeze some celery so that the water inside gets frozen, and then it's like, crunch, you know, as they twist the celery that mixes in with like the sound of the dude's ribs breaking or whatever it happens to be.
And for even gorier sounds.
If you're picturing like, I don't know, Saving Private Ryan or something, and like your intestines are just spilling out on the beach, you know, might.
A wet rag will often do the trick.
If you sort of like feel a little uncomfortable as you're like making the sound, then you probably did it well. It isn't quite what's real, but it sounds real, and it tricks the brain basically into thinking, yeah, I guess that is what that sounds like.
So how is it that a vegetable and a hand towel are able to pull one over on us?
Sound as we hear it is changes in pressure in the air. Those cause your eardrum to vibrate, which make it into your brain, and you interpret this as sound.
That's Alma Zook, a professor of physics at Pomona College. There's a number of main properties that define what something sounds like, such as volume or timbre. But here, what's important is
pitch or frequency. That's how high or low it sounds, and that corresponds to how rapidly the air is moving.
So for celery to sound like breaking bones,
the sound it's imitating is a very short-lived sound. And so that means that it has to involve high frequencies.
And the high frequencies are responsible for the snapping sound.
The waveform looks kind of irregular. This graph is just basically has peaks and valleys everywhere.
But why celery?
It tends to be long and skinny, and lots of bones are long and skinny. And if you get it fresh or if you freeze it, then it's pretty crisp, so it's stiff the way bones are.
But how do Foley artists make sounds in film that don't exist in the real world?
The art of Foley is you have to use your imagination.
That's Gary Hecker. He is really famous. You could call him the Scorsese of Foley.
I do a lot of superhero films. I do like Batman, Superman film, Justice League, and all the Spider-Man films.
And about 20 years ago, on the first Spider-Man movie, Gary invented an iconic sound. The superhero's web shooting out and hitting bad guys.
To get that sound of where web's attached to something, we cut these little thin little leather strips, like a pom-pom, maybe 40 of them. Then I took audio tape, laid that on the surface of whatever it was, whether it was glass or metal, and then those strips, when you hit the audio tape, it sounds just like.
Spider-Man's web, unlike the fight scene sounds, isn't trying to match anything in reality. Without any physics to reference, when it comes to Spider-Man's web, there's just one way a sound team decides if it, quote-unquote, works.
Because it's just so cool.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out!
That story was reported by Ari Saperstein. The famous Foley artist he interviewed, Gary Hecker, also created the sound for Quentin Tarantino's movie Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. That movie won a single award at the Cannes Film Fest, the Palm Dog Award. It went to Sayuri, a pit bull who played Brad Pitt's dog in that movie. In the film, she's both a fierce fighter and a loyal friend.
You understand? All right.
Tarantino said when he was editing Once Upon a Time, he started noticing things in Sayuri's face and appreciating what a great, quote, emotional performance she gave.
Hey, she's kind of a good actress.
How could a dog actually be an actor? Steph Yin looked into this.
In the 1925 Western, Clash of the Wolves, there's a scene where the main character, a heroic wolf dog named Lobo, gets injured. He's the leader of his pack, and he doesn't want to be a liability.
Because he knows that he will attract danger to his pack if he stays with them. And he's crawling to the edge of this cliff that he's going to hurl himself off of.
That's author Susan Orlean. In 2011, she wrote a biography about the German shepherd who starred in that movie. His name was Rin Tin Tin. The scene on the cliff is one of Susan's favorites, because in it, Rin Tin Tin looks truly sad. Maybe it's the look in his eyes, or the way he holds his body. Either way,
you believe it, and you watch him, and he looks really depressed, and you feel silly afterwards, thinking, oh my god, it's a dog acting.
Of course, Rin Tin Tin can't read the script.
But he does make you feel moved the way a human actor would move you. And you feel that he understands what the story is. He was really able to project emotion and to appear vulnerable.
What's going on when a dog like Rin Tin Tin seems to be conveying emotion, deep emotion, to the point of moving us? The first step is to understand the actual emotions dogs can feel. Animal behaviorist Mary Birch says, we can't say for sure how many feelings dogs experience, but in general, think of them as having about the emotional range of a 2-year-old human.
Dogs have many of the same basic emotions as humans do. So they show us joy and fear, excitement, depression, anger.
They can feel frustrated, surprised, and relaxed. They feel love or attachment. What they don't experience, behaviorists think, are some of the more complex emotions, like pride, shame, or guilt. You might think your dog is feeling guilty when he's eaten something from the garbage and is acting skittish. But Mary says that's likely just conditioning. Your dog is anticipating punishment and feeling scared, not guilty.
He's in the garbage, the owner screams and yells, and finally, he begins to look kind of fearful or guilty, what looks guilty to humans, when he's engaging in those behaviors.
So if dogs don't have the full deck of human emotions, how can you get them to pull off emotional scenes?
A dog lover lives here.
Carol Rosen trains dogs in showbiz. She lives in Maryland.
Hello.
Hi, that's Jessie.
Carol's worked on House of Cards and several films. She says you can elicit the basic emotions that dogs do feel by tapping into a dog's natural instincts, like hunting or herding. It's kind of like method acting for dogs.
So you try to find things that they enjoy doing because it makes it so much more fun.
Come on, Good girl.
That works for things like excitement or aggression. But what if you want a dog to act out a more complex emotion, like shame? Carol says she would try to simulate how a human might act out shame.
We're going to teach behaviors where the dog puts his head down and then puts a paw over his eyes.
Carol shows me with her German Shepherd, Jesse.
And we shape it. We teach them a command called touch, where they just... A dog will naturally reach out and touch your hand. Touch.
From there, Carol can use her hand to direct Jesse's head down.
So Jesse, head down.
With a lot of patience, Carol builds up from these basic movements, step by step, to create long chains of behaviors or stunt sequences. But while a trainer can teach a dog to put its head down and cover its eyes, it's us in the audience filling in the rest and calling it shame or guilt. One thing that helps is that dogs' faces work somewhat similarly to ours. Leslie Irvin, director of the Animals in Society program at the University of Colorado Boulder, says dogs have co-evolved alongside humans for thousands of years. In many ways, we're cognitively hardwired to relate with and map our emotions onto dogs.
There's been some research about interpreting dogs' facial expressions, and expert dog trainers have been asked to interpret dogs' facial expressions in a variety of settings, and they've been pretty much on target in terms of whether they're able to pick up whether dogs are happy, sad, surprised, neutral, disgusted,
When dogs are happy, they often open their mouths and loosen their lips. When they're curious, they'll tilt their heads. A nose wrinkle paired with a snarl might mean, "I'm annoyed, back off." Dogs have even evolved a whole new facial muscle that wolves don't have, the levator anguli oculi medialis. It allows dogs to raise their eyebrows, which they can use to express surprise, interest, sadness. And it's thought this muscle evolved because it enhances communication between dogs and humans. This hard wiring for human-dog empathy gets at the last thing that makes a dog a good actor. A super tight bond with its trainer. Remember Rin Tin Tin? Not only was he very athletic and very smart, he had an extraordinarily strong connection with his trainer, Lee Duncan. As a young soldier during World War I, Lee came across Rin Tin Tin on a battlefield in France. Here's writer Susan Orlean again.
He decided to keep the puppy and raised it in his barracks during the war.
The two formed an intense partnership.
The connection was so deep. I mean, we all love our dogs. For Lee Duncan, this was a really singular emotional connection, and they were never apart.
On set, it was always Lee who was behind the camera, giving Rin Tin Tin cues. Now that I knew all these details, I went back and watched that scene with Rin Tin Tin on the cliff that Susan had told me about. Rin Tin Tin is limping, then crawling toward the cliff's edge. At some points, he lies down, like he's ready to give up. It's an impressive sequence of behaviors. No doubt, Lee Duncan's behind the camera, giving him the cues they've practiced in training. But that deep vulnerability, that sadness in his eyes that Susan and I wondered about, I realized the whole time he's on that cliff, we never even get a super close look at Rin Tin Tin's face. It turns out there's a lot that makes a dog a good actor. Talent, yes. A good trainer, yes. Also, us, our minds, filling in what we want to see.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're listening back to an episode we produced earlier this year about movies, how movie magic works in our brains and plays on our emotions. Remember when Joaquin Phoenix was on The Letterman Show in 2009? He had a big beard and he was totally spaced out. It was really weird.
You got a nice beard going? And
Oh, yeah, thank you.
How is that, the beard?
In my way.
Well, is it comfortable? Is it itchy? Is it? Are you pleased with it?
I'm okay with it, but now you're making me feel weird about it.
I'm sorry, I'm making you feel weird about it?
Is there something wrong?
I can't be the first one to make you feel weird about it.
No, I guess not.
People were freaking out. Is this real? Is he acting? What is going on? It later turned out that Joaquin Phoenix was acting and David Letterman didn't know. The line between real life and acting seems to get blurry sometimes. Reporter Jad Slayman has more.
On the HBO show Crashing, she was a friendly frisbee player in Central Park.
Hey.
Mind if I?
Sure. If you want to play, you're more than welcome.
Okay, thanks. We will.
And on Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, she was an eager young resort worker.
Oh, Susie, you can put your ditty bag in the space under my bed if you want.
What did you call it?
A ditty bag? What do you call it?
You can also catch her in a skincare commercial making the rounds.
So if you see a brunette lady who says, when I had acne, I made up a lot of excuses not to go out. That's me. That's me.
Addie Weirich is a writer, comedian, and actress living in Los Angeles. She was home for a visit in Philly last year, and she was hiding something.
I have this memory of being a little girl and my mom being like, listen, you can pierce your ears as much as you want, but just please, no piercings on your face and no tattoos.
No face piercings, but Addie broke that second prohibition. She had been in Sweden studying theater improv, and to commemorate the experience and give a nod to Philly sports, she decided on a small tattoo.
I got Trust the Process, but it says Lita på processen, which means trust the process in Swedish. And I got it tattooed under my right boob. So easy to be hidden.
She was home for the holidays, having successfully hidden Lita Puprosesin for 2 months at this point.
I'm not saying like we're a naked family in like a weird way, but like I've changed in front of my parents, especially in front of my mom. And my mom is laying on my bed and we're having a conversation and I'm changing my clothes.
And then Addie remembers the tattoo. She tries nonchalantly turning away from her mom to hide the ink.
And she stops what she's saying and she's like, "Hey, what's up? What'd you do? And I was like, oh, what? I'm just putting my shirt on. And she was like, why'd you turn around? Like, caught me immediately. She's a journalist. She has a crazy Hawkeye. I forget all the time. She's a very smart lady.
Mom is Ronnie Polineski, a journalist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. She wasn't thinking tattoo, but she knew something was up.
And I thought, did she have an injury? Did she have a fall? Did someone hurt her? I mean, I didn't know because it was so not like her.
For Addie, it was showtime.
Mom, I feel really bad about my body right now, and I just don't want anyone to look at it, and I don't want you to look at it. I don't want to see you see me looking at it because I just don't like my body right now. So just don't look at it.
For your consideration, Addie Weirich as insecure daughter at the end of her rope.
I did it so well that, like, I was crying and really believing it.
And mom?
And then she was like, I'm so sorry. Like, we can, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Like, let's make sure you have a therapist.
It worked. Like, her mom believed her performance.
I tell you, I won. I got it. She did not look again.
It worked maybe a little too well.
I think she even managed to get herself to cry a little. She made me feel really guilty for even asking or noticing. And I thought, you know, she's a young woman and, you know, they get horrible messages about their bodies.
Ronnie even brought up the episode to her husband later.
Like, wow, she's really having a hard time about her body.
Actors make us believe them. It's their job. Marlon Brando really is heartbroken, yelling out for his wife.
Hey, Stella!
Jack Nicholson is actually furious, screaming down the prosecution.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
But all that happens on screen. How often could actors use those skills in the real world? Gregory Donaldson used his acting training on a New York City subway to stay safe. He was writing about gangs in the late 80s.
I would have a bit of a sour look on my face, and it's got to do with posture.
If there were menacing teenagers on the train, he wanted them to think, 5-0, that's probably a cop.
I would make eye contact with the kids, and the look I had on my face was one of that I was somewhat bored, a bit amused.
These little changes in posture or facial expression, actors call them adjustments, little tweaks that make you into a different person. These days, Gregory teaches a theater and criminal justice course at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, does little scenes with aspiring cops. Decades ago, he studied under the famous Sandy Meisner, who developed a type of method acting known simply as Meisner. Jeff Goldblum, Diane Keaton, and a bunch of other stars studied under him. A hallmark of the Meisner method is repetition. You just keep saying and listening to the same line over and over.
And it begins to become apparent to you as you're doing it that the words are meaningless, that it's the feeling beneath the words.
He was in a scene in one class where his wife comes home in the middle of the night. His line was, "Where were you?"
And on the third or fourth or fifth, "Where were you?" the anger was, "I was out of my chair. And I was ready to throw the table across the room."
He also tries to tap into what he calls his emotional memory.
To that reservoir of your real feelings, your real reactions, your real emotions.
So if actors are good at tapping into their emotional memory, can they just do it in everyday situations? Like, for instance, to lie? Even though he got away with his cop act on the subway, Gregory tells me acting is an art, not a deception, that great actors use some kind of truth to make an imaginary situation convincing.
I would argue that good liars are pretty good actors most of the time, but that does not mean that good actors are necessarily good liars.
Pamela Meyer has written extensively about lie detection and runs Calibrate, a company that offers lie detection training.
There's an overlap in the skills required to do both, but they are actually separate disciplines.
The skill that most overlaps between liars and actors is convincing an appropriate emotion. Remember how Addie, feigning insecurity, got so emotional she was actually crying? Bad liars have what Pamela calls an emotional gap.
You know, they're saying something really dramatic, but they're not conveying an attitude that matches that. Or oftentimes we see this with in murder cases. You'll see someone's talking about a horrific crime, but they're kind of devoid of emotions.
Or maybe they convey the wrong emotion, what they think people expect instead of what's real.
We associate surprise with the happy surprise party from when, you know, you had your sweet 16 surprise party, but the average person does not like to be surprised. It's a very unpleasant experience.
Notice at your next surprise party, more often than not, it's horror that flashes across the birthday girl's face for a quick moment before turning to smiles. But pulling off pitch-perfect emotion is only one part of a good lie.
When somebody is lying, oftentimes the cognitive load is so high on them. They're trying to think what to say, act composed, appear spontaneous. You know, what they do is they leak these verbal and nonverbal indicators of deceit.
The cognitive load is so great, Pamela says, because liars have to constantly self-monitor. They have to know, for instance, that maybe they feel scared internally, but they have to convey sadness to their mark. They don't have a script to rely on. Lying is basically way more work than acting.
You can be a good actor without necessarily being able to think quickly on your feet, mentally, you know, being mentally agile. You can be a good actor without necessarily having an amazing working memory that allows you to hold two or three different ideas in at the same time.
All this sounds a bit closer to improv than acting to me. So I ask Pamela, are improv artists the ones we should really be worried about?
I would agree with that. I think that a good improv artist oftentimes bears more resemblance to a good liar than a good actor does.
I put all this to Addie, the value of thinking on your feet, cognitive load, and it makes sense to her. She says even though on paper she's made more money as an actor, she considers herself a comedian at heart. Her theater improv training in Sweden, where she got the forbidden tattoo, may have prepared her for the deception perfectly. There's no script, just a scene, and then you go. For example, a scene where a patient is told they'll be turned into a chicken in 4 months.
I don't want to be a chicken! And you're like sobbing and you're crying and it's so funny.
Applying real emotion to a given situation on the fly, it's impressive. And pretty common offstage, Addie tells me. In her improv comedy circle of friends, they have to make a rule about it. When we're just hanging out offstage and offset, no bits. Stop doing your act.
We'll say no bits. Like, or we'll say like bit block of being like, yo, no bits. Like, don't, like, not joking around. This is how I actually feel this way.
Some of her friends are maybe too good at it.
Dude, I can't tell if you're doing a bit right now or not. Should I be worried about you?
Eventually, Addie dropped the insecure body image bit she had done with her mom. She came clean.
So she said, remember that day when I was covering up my chest? And I said, yes. And she said, I was covering up a tattoo. And I said, you lied. I said, you made me feel so bad for even asking.
At first, Ronnie was mad.
And I said, you know, that was really mean because I'm sorry.
But also, she was weirdly impressed.
And I'm like, and then I thought, how did you do that?
Like, damn, my daughter can act.
Just objectively speaking, I was like, she's good. She's really good.
That was Jad Slaman reporting. We're talking about movies. Think about your favorite love scene in a movie. Maybe it felt so real that you thought the couple was actually together. If two people pretend to be in love on a movie set, does that lead to real chemistry, real feelings? And why do we get so obsessed with those romances? Alan Yu has more.
Remember the 2019 Oscars? Lady Gaga in a stunning black dress and Bradley Cooper step on stage to perform Shallow, the smash hit from A Star Is Born.
Tell me something, girl.
They look at each other the whole time.
Are you happy in this modern world?
In the end, Bradley Cooper sits down next to Lady Gaga on the piano bench.
In the shallow.
Their heads touch. Their eyes are closed. And then it looks like they're going to kiss. The air around them feels electric.
We're far from the shallow now.
Audiences freaked out. Twitter exploded. It was all everybody could talk about. People get so invested in fictional pairings. It's real to the audience, but is it real for the actors? Does pretend love become real love? Talia Goldstein used to be an actor. Now, she's a psychologist. She says that on the one hand, American acting theory relies on the idea that actors experience, or at least conjure up, the emotions that they portray. And that's quite similar to how psychologists study emotion. Let's say psychologists want to study how people in love make decisions. They might ask participants to think back to a time when they were in love.
Many, many researchers on emotion use this sort of fake portrayal of emotion as the stand-in for the real emotion that people experience spontaneously and consider it to be relatively the same thing. So if that's true, then you would expect sort of this falling in love outcome to happen.
Which would mean that when actors play people in love, they experience love. On the other hand, a researcher asked actors to get into character as Romeo or Juliet, practice monologues from the play. Then they would talk in character in a brain scanner to see what was happening in their brains. When the actors talked in character, the brain patterns looked similar to the actors talking about their own personal lives. But then this other part of the brain that's associated with attention control would kick in.
It's that sort of reminder of like, oh, this is just pretend, this is just imagination, and therefore there's no sort of quote-unquote real outcome from it.
Sometimes acting like you love a person can be a real challenge. Actress Jenny Bacon has a lot of experience playing people in love. Way back in her career, she had a co-star playing her love interest, who was not kind to her offstage.
We were instructed to kiss passionately for very long periods of time. And he could see that my face was getting cut by his beard, which he insisted on keeping at a particular place. And I drew their attention to the fact that it was hurting me, but they didn't care.
And yet she had to kiss this person on stage night after night.
And I have to say, I did throw up many times before going to the show, but I did it. So yeah, it can be awful. It can be truly awful.
To make love scenes seem real, you have to make sure the actors feel safe and comfortable. Many productions now have intimacy directors who make sure the actors are okay with what they're doing and know exactly what a particular scene calls for. Which means love scenes involve a lot of work.
What we think of as chemistry is actually really good acting.
That's Colleen Hughes, an actor and intimacy director in Philadelphia.
And the reality is that sometimes you might see two actors who are in an actual relationship and they don't seem to have any quote-unquote chemistry on stage. That's not because they don't care about each other, you know, in their real lives, but it's because it's a very different thing. And as intimacy directors, we work with the actors to create that fantastic, sparkly tension between the two of them that the audience can read. And that's so different than just leaving it up to the actors.
Colleen says actors have to portray that spark the same way night after night for the entire run of a show. On a movie set, it might take shot after shot, retake after retake. Because of that consistency, two actors performing as people in love are not experiencing real love, says Annie G. Levy, the artistic director of Emerson Stage at Emerson College.
You know, if the kiss lasts 3 seconds on opening night, that kiss should never last more than 3 seconds all the way till closing night. And again, it protects the integrity of the story being told, and it protects both actors, whether they are falling for each other or not.
So repetition and predictability, the same kiss time and time again, should actually make it unlikely that actors will really fall in love. But theater director Jessica Thebus says if a love scene is done well, it will still feel magical, even if you know the actors have done it over and over for weeks.
But if it's done well, because this is the thing, it's an intimate moment. I like the strangeness, and I like the fact that it's false and real. The kissing is just a perfect example of that. And I think we all just like being close to that mystery. We like being close to that risk and that strangeness.
Kiss.
That was Alan Yu reporting. Emotions can run high on movie sets, and when they boil over, you need somebody to jump in.
My role is to alleviate crisis on the set or in the production team.
That's Barton Goldsmith. He's a psychotherapist who specializes in therapy on movie sets. For production crews, the days are long, often at least 12 hours. There's a lot of money at stake. Everybody is stressed out. The crew spends a lot of time together. They get very close. And Barton says fights are inevitable.
There's no way you're not going to step on somebody else's toes or they're not going to step on yours. And when that happens, I handle it like a family. I handle it like family therapy.
He says having a therapist on the set saves time and money. People talk through their issues. Big blowout fights are avoided. Everything runs more smoothly.
By just adding another person to the crew, that allows their cast and production crew to blow off some steam in a constructive way rather than a destructive way.
Another part of Barton's job is to help actors when they are transitioning between scenes.
Think of a performer who in the morning has to get ready to play a very emotional scene, a lot of crying, maybe some hitting, fighting. They have to bring up a lot of pain and personal experience to do it really, really well. And then in the afternoon, they have to completely switch roles and be funny and light. In the meantime, they've still got all the adrenaline and cortisol from all of the anger they had to manufacture in their brains and hearts, coursing through their bodies.
So they need some help switching gears.
You can't push that stuff away. It's going to keep staying inside of you until you process it out. And that processing can be talking, it can be crying, it can be beating pillows with tennis rackets. There's a lot of different ways to go about doing it. But if you don't process it out, it's going to stick with you. And that meltdown is going to continue until you are able to get in touch with the feelings and release the pain.
And I would think there's so much adrenaline involved, too, in acting, especially when you're acting out stressful scenes, violent scenes, and that adrenaline has to go somewhere.
As does the cortisol, and it wipes out all of your serotonin and dopamine as well. So, yeah, when you're getting into a violent scene or a very, very dramatic scene, adrenaline, cortisol are coming into your system, and yes, it takes a while for that to go away.
And sometimes Barton helps actors create those deep emotions in the first place. I'm wondering if you can give me an example. Let's say I'm preparing for a scene in the afternoon where somebody dumps me and I'm heartbroken and it's terrible and it comes out of nowhere. How would you prepare me for that emotionally?
We'd go back to the last time you were dumped and we would talk about that and how that made you feel.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get into that feeling. What you are still holding on to, what it is, how it affects you. Did you use memories from your past? And then after the scene, you would come back to me and we would get you out of it. Not only does that help you get in touch with what it is you want to do on set, but it also helps you get in touch with the feelings that you had so that you can drill down on those and get rid of them. Let them go after you have exploited them on stage, use them, gotten them out of your system, and then you can really get rid of them. It's actually kind of therapeutic.
Yeah, I was thinking that. It sounds empowering in a way.
It can be. Let me give you another example of someone who I worked with. This person had to do a scene where she was dying of cancer, and she actually was dying of cancer. And it was a very, very difficult day on set for everyone because no one knew up until this point. And we had to slowly walk through the entire process. And she had a lot of processing to do about her own fears, her own loss of life. And she loved life, loved it. one of the finest performers and performances I've ever had the pleasure of witnessing in my career.
Barton Goldsmith is a licensed psychotherapist who provides therapy on movie sets. Coming up, when the coronavirus pandemic first started to really hit the U.S. in early March, lots of people were downloading the 2011 movie Contagion.
You ever seen anything like this before?
No. And it's still changing. It's figuring us out faster than we're figuring it out.
It doesn't have anything else to do. So we have a novel virus with a mortality rate in the low 20s, no treatment protocol, and no vaccine at this time.
That is correct.
We take a look at the connection between real-life science and scary movies. That's next on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're listening back to an episode we produced earlier this year about science and movies. Scientific discoveries often serve as a creative spark for films, especially really scary ones. From Los Angeles, Avishai Artsy reports.
At the beginning of the cult classic horror movie, The Creature from the Black Lagoon, a scientist discovers a fossil that looks kind of like a webbed hand, and he brings it back to show his team.
It's amazing. It's incredible. Could it possibly belong to a Pleistocene man?
The scientists think it may have belonged to a missing link between fish and humans.
And so they go out into the Amazon and try to recover more fossils or potentially even a living creature.
Sarah Crawford works at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. She says the concept for the human-like sea monster comes from a real-life story, the rediscovery of an ancient fish called the coelacanth. People thought it went extinct tens of millions of years ago. The fish also inspired the monster's webbed hand.
Most fish have ray fins, which, you know, they're not as muscular. They don't have as many bones as a coelacanth. So when you look at the coelacanth fin, it looks kind of fleshy. It looks like a vestigial kind of hand almost.
In the movie, the slimy webbed hand with sharp claws is what you first see emerging from the water. Soon, a fish-man creature wreaks murderous havoc on the scientists. There are so many horror movies inspired by science that Sarah Crawford created a whole exhibition about it. It's called Natural History of Horror.
And it looks at the science behind some of the most iconic movie monsters of our time. So Frankenstein, Dracula, Creature from the Black Lagoon, and The Mummy.
Are the movies scary at all?
I think they were scary at the time, and something I can certainly tell you is it's been really fun to watch visitors in the exhibition. We actually have projections with clips from all four horror films in the center of the gallery, and I've seen a lot of kids run out of the gallery screaming, so I think that the movies definitely hold up.
The connection between scientific discoveries and horror movies goes way back. Karina Wilson is a horror movie historian, and she says it makes sense because they both explore the unknown.
Science can be very scary, and unregulated science could lead to terrifying new developments. And horror is a way of warning people, do not go here, do not trespass.
Often, horror movies explore fears about scientific discoveries or advances. During the First World War, mortar shells caused most of the disastrous injuries, but medical advances made it possible to save more soldiers, who often came back home completely changed.
In previous wars, such as the American Civil War, the wounded died. In the First World War, they were patched back up and sent home, often with ruined faces, missing limbs, as well as shattered minds.
Horror movies explore these experiences and the collective trauma.
That's when you get The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which was made in 1919 in Germany.
It's a silent movie about a sleepwalking murderer.
And many people have suggested it represents the soldiers who came back from the front who were husks of their former selves. They were unable to cope with even the simplest loud sound. They had shell shock, what we would now call PTSD.
In the 1920s and 30s, scientists started to be portrayed as villains. There was a major debate over teaching evolution in schools. Religious leaders condemned it, and major Hollywood studios were scared of government censorship, so they made their films more moral and made scientists the bad guys.
So that's why Victor Frankenstein is seen as such a hubristic, evil figure in many ways. He's not the hero of the movie. He's the one who sets a terrible thing into motion and has to deal with it.
This movie came out in 1931, and Victor Frankenstein famously animates a corpse using lightning.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
It explores man in the role of creator, blurring the lines between life and death. The author of Frankenstein got the idea from an actual science experiment. Here's Sarah Crawford again from the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County.
Mary Shelley was inspired in part by the work of an Italian scientist called Luigi Galvani and his work in animal electricity. He took frog legs, attached them to some wires, put them outside, and waited for them to get struck by lightning, which caused the frog legs to move. You know, over a decade later, he has a nephew, actually, who tours around Europe performing this experiment essentially in public. And he actually, at one point, does this with a corpse. And so he's electrocuting animals and dead bodies in front of audiences and causing them to move, and people believe that they were seeing, you know, the key to life.
Oh, in the name of God, now I know what it feels like to be God.
After the Second World War and the dropping of the atomic bomb, it was the nuclear engineers that inspired a wave of horror movies. James Kendrick teaches horror film history at Baylor University.
So you start getting movies like Tarantula or Godzilla, the Beast from 50,000 Fathoms. You know, these movies about either normal animals or creatures being mutated and turned monstrous via atomic energy, or prehistoric beasts being awoken by atomic testing.
So there are monsters created in a lab or let loose by radiation, and then as we start to struggle with superbugs like MRSA, that's what we see in horror films, viruses that spread through air or by blood, like in Outbreak, Contagion, and here in 28 Days Later.
Jimmy's infected!
No! No!
Jim! No! Jim, get it!
In the movie, a rage virus created in a lab spreads, turning anyone infected into violent zombies.
And it has the effect of making sort of everything terrifying, because if there's an infection spreading around, if there's a virus going around, well, any person around you might be carrying that virus. And so it turns people on each other and makes you fearful of everybody around you.
With every new breakthrough in technology, there's a horror movie delving into our fears about the science behind it. As we keep pushing the boundaries of artificial intelligence, gene editing, planetary exploration, and so on, who knows what monsters we might create or uncover? For The Pulse, I'm Avishai Artsy.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Chad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.